Let's open our Bibles to the 21st chapter of Deuteronomy. Continuing, we're still in Moses' second sermon that he had given to this generation of Israelites right before they passed across the Jordan River. And we will be in it again next week, too. It's the longest section of the whole book. And we're going to be looking at some things tonight that most of the book of Deuteronomy, the second law, is a reiteration of what we find in the book of Leviticus and Numbers and even in Exodus in the earlier instruction that was given to these guys' parents. But we'll see some things tonight that are new, unique to the book of Deuteronomy. And we're also going to run into some things that are just a little bit strange. You know, a lot of things we see even in the Old Testament where God says, here's how I want you to do this, here's how I want you to handle that. And a lot of these things, we can kind of see the practical application of it. It can make sense to us. There's some things that maybe the Israelites didn't understand at the time, like the prohibition of eating pork. They didn't know why they weren't supposed to eat pork, but now, you know, centuries later, we can see the wisdom in that, in the way that the meat was treated in those days and so forth. But then there's some things that even for us today that we may not be able to understand the practical wisdom behind it, but we can trust that there is some. And so let's just jump in. One of the things in chapter 21 we're going to see that God's care, God's concern over the conduct of the people's lives, that he has there's a sanctity of living creatures that God has that he shows that was pretty foreign for this culture. And he says, if anyone is found slain, lying in the field in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess, and it's not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding cities. So the first thing that he's going to address here in chapter 21 is, what do you do when you find somebody who has been killed? There's a homicide out in the middle of a field, and yet you have no suspects. You don't have any perps. And how do you deal with it? And so he said, the first thing you do is you get the elders of the surrounding areas, and they're going to break out their tape measures, and they're going to measure and see how far he is to the closest city to find out what jurisdiction the guy would fall in. And this reminds me of many years ago, when I had this car wreck. I'm home from work on a Friday night, and I was over here on 50th Street, right there beside Wiley Post, and this gal drifted over into my lane, and we had this head-on accident. We were both pretty seriously injured. And the guy that was right behind me had a cell phone, and so he called 911. And he said, there's been this very serious car wreck on Northwest 50th between Rockwell and Council. And the 911 operator said, well, which side of 50th is it on? And he said, well, it's kind of in the middle. And she said, well, would you say that it was more to the north side of the middle or to the south side of the middle? And the guy said, I don't know what difference it would make. And she said, well, that's the city dividing line right there, and I need to know which jurisdiction it falls under. I need to know who to call out. And he said, well, it's kind of in the middle of the middle. And so she sent out both jurisdictions, which was good because we had two officers coming to investigate, and we had two sets of ambulances coming to take care of us. That's kind of what they're doing here. They're wanting to know who's going to be responsible, whose jurisdiction does it fall under. So break out a tape measure and see which the closest village. And then it shall be, verse 3, that the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will take a heifer, which is not been worked, and it has not pulled with a yoke, and the elders of the city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. And if you got the old King James, it says, you bring this little heifer, this young heifer that's never plowed, going to take it down to a field that's never been sown, and take it down to this river, this flowing water, and break its neck. Or if you got the old King James, it's going to say, strike off the neck. And we can kind of look at this and we can go, and this is justice? I mean, this is how they're going to solve the crime? Don't think of it in that kind of a sense. That's not what God is saying. What he's saying is that there is no solution to the crime. It's a tragedy. It's a bummer. There's an innocent victim that has been slain out in this field. And so this is to basically show that you're going to take this young heifer, innocent young calf that that's never been yoked, that's never plowed before, going to take it into a field that's never been plowed or sown, and it's just showing the innocence, the virginness of the situation. And then this cow, this heifer, will represent the victim that was slain. And it's more of a symbolic kind of a thing. And then in verse 5 it says, the priest, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. By their word, every controversy and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of the city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And then they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have I seen it. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. And the atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. And so you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. This does sound kind of weird to us, but we got to understand that in this culture, in that society back then, to see a dead man on the side of the road, they would just shove him out of the way. You know, it didn't matter. You know, there wasn't that kind of concern. There wasn't this sense of justice. Oh, yeah, if you knew who the perpetrator was, if you knew who had committed the crime, you would do something to him, or you would have the kinsman redeemer come and do it. But what if you just have somebody that dies and you don't know what to do with it? God says, okay, you don't know what to do with it, but I want you to know that I care, that I've noticed this person. And so you guys will go through this ceremony to absolve yourself from any responsibility. But this is going to symbolize this murdered victim. And then the atonement would come through the Lord's mercy and grace. And then he says in verse 10, when you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her and would take her for your wife, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. Or again, if you got the old King James, is going to pare her nails. Literally, the word means do. In fact, of the multiple times, the dozens of times this word occurs in the Old Testament, it's the word do. You're going to go home and she's going to do her hair, she's going to do her nails. Shave her head. I'm not quite sure what the attractiveness of that is. But the idea is if you go and lay siege to a city, and the city falls to you, and you go in and you take the women, the children captive, and then you see one of the captive women, and you kind of take a shine to her, then this is what you do. Take her to your home, and you're going to shave her head, you're going to do her nails, and then she's going to be shut up for this period of time. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity and remain in your house and mourn her father and mother for a full month. After that, you may go into her and be your husband, and she shall be your wife. Now, the Bible guys are somewhat divided over this, the clothes of her captivity, what that means. Some of them would say, you know, it's just like she's wearing sackcloth and it's just kind of, she looks like the peasant, and you know how it would be typified in some modern movie or something. And those would be the clothes of her captivity. Some of the other commentators said, no, that's not what it is at all. It's quite the opposite, in fact. Because when you would lay siege to a city, they could almost kind of set their watches by the siege. You know, they could look and they say, well, city's going to fall in 5 days. And then you'd build the mound up a little bit more. The city's going to fall in 4 days and 3 days. And then at one point they're saying, you know what? By tomorrow at noon, city's going to fall. We're all going to be toast. And now the men in the city knew what would happen to them. You know, the guys would come over the wall and they'd take all the men in the city and they would kill them. The women and the children, there were options for them. Especially if you were a pretty woman. And so what they would do, though, what some of the commentators say is that what the close of their captivity is referring to is that on the morning of the siege, they would get up early and they would get all gussied up and they would foo-foo and they would curl and they would spit shine and they would get all everything going just right so that they would kind of stand out among the crowd so that when the attacking army would come over the wall, they would stand out. And somebody would say, oh, I like her, hubba hubba. And they would take her home. And so the better you look, the greater your chances would be. And some of the commentators say this is what the clothes of the captivity are. But she's going to put off those clothes of her captivity, and she's going to remain shut up while she mourns her father and mother for a month. And then at the end of the month, if you want her, you can have her as your wife. You can go into her, and she can be your wife. And it shall be, 14, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free. You know, I don't know what this means. I mean, some guys think that, I mean, you've been looking at her bald head for a month, you know, and you're thinking, I don't want her. And then if that's the case, then let her free, set her free. But you shall certainly not sell her for money, and you shall not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. Now, what does that mean, the humbling? Some of the commentators think that this is referring to the fact that the guy would have had some sort of relations with her, sexual relations. He's humbled her through that. That seems to be contrary to what Moses is saying to him, though. Other commentators say just the idea that you shaved her head and made her put off the clothes of her captivity for a month, that's humbling enough. And that may be more likely what it is. Probably. Even though the text doesn't go into this, this is the way I kind of lean. That during this month, you've had a chance to interact with her. And being the good Jewish man that you are, you've been telling her about Yahweh. You've been telling her about the God of your forefathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And possibly at the end of the month, she might be saying, I want to know more about this God. What does it take to be a Yahweh follower? And then the captor would say, you know what? I kind of like this gal. She's going to make me a nice Jewish wife. Or she might be saying, you know what? After a month, she might be saying, I was born a pagan. I'm going to die a pagan. And so then the guy would say, okay, then I don't have any delight in her. It's probably something kind of along those lines. And if that's the case, then she's been through enough. Just set her free. Let her go. That was very radical for that day and age, to just have someone who was a captive and then just turn them free. Without selling them or without getting anything for your troubles. That was a very radical development. And then he says in verse 15, if a man has two wives. Now, just that phrase right there is enough to raise eyebrows. You know, if a man has two wives, loved one and the other unloved. Okay. Kind of like a Leah and Rebecca thing, or the Leah and Rachel thing. It says, and they've borne him children, both the loved and the unloved. And if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, in other words, if the first son that the guy has, because your firstborn son would be the guy that would be who gets to inherit all of your money, you know, gets the double portion. But if he happens to be of the son of the one that you didn't love, and then it shall be, verse 16, on the day that he bequeaths his possessions to his sons, that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife, in preference of the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. You know, so if you got son A came from the unloved one and son B comes from the loved one, and then on the day you're passing on the family inheritance, you decide to choose son B because he came from the wife that you loved more, Moses says, ain't going to happen. You're not going to do it that way. But it shall, verse 17, he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Now, there's probably a lot of questions that come to our minds. If I were to stop here and have a question and answer period, I would probably think somebody would raise a question and they would say, isn't that what David did? Right? I mean, he put off his firstborn so that he could choose Solomon because he loved Bathsheba. And isn't that what David did? Didn't he violate this? Yeah, I would say it is. You know, and but David was known for doing a lot of things that were contrary to God's law. And I would say this is just one of them. You know, he was one of many who kind of had this right of majesty sort of attitude and thought that the law, these sort of provisions and these sort of prohibitions were for the common people and they were above them. And I would say that David was pretty much in violation of Deuteronomy 21. But then we come up with the question about, what about the idea of having two wives anyway? How do you explain that? I mean, what is this idea of plurality of wives? And I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to state it. I can tell you what I do know about it, and then you can draw your own conclusions. I can say that in the words of Jesus himself, he says, in the beginning, that's not what God had in mind. In the beginning, God created Adam and Eve. You know, he didn't create Adam and Eve and Lulabelle. You know, I mean, that wasn't God's design in the very beginning. He didn't have a plan of plural wives. Was he accommodating the culture? I don't think that's what God does. Is he just acknowledging that's what happens? Maybe. I as I said, I don't really fully understand this. Many of the commentators, and it's kind of interesting, when sometimes when you're reading commentaries, and you'll see like many of them will make a comment about this would be better translated as such and such, and then you look up all the different translations you can look at, and none of them translate it that way. And I'm not enough of a Hebrew guy to know why, but many of the commentators say that literally what this says is he who has had two wives. Not that he who has two wives, but he who has had two wives. So it could be talking about not having two wives parallel, but having two wives serially. You know, he had one wife and then later had another, maybe she died, and then he had another wife after that. That could be what it's referring to. But anyway, you can't give all your blessings to the son of the one that you loved if he wasn't the legitimate firstborn. By the way, the reason why they did this, why they didn't, you know, today when somebody dies, they say, I take all of my inheritance and I divide it up equally among all my heirs. And the reason why they didn't do it in those days, because the majority of your worth was in your land. And if you did that to the land, if a guy had 7 acres and had 7 sons, then divided it among the 7 sons, then there would only be 7 one-acre plots. And then if one of the owners of that 1 acre had 7 sons, and then he died and divided that 1 acre among the 7 sons, before long there wouldn't be any land to divide. So that's one of the primary reasons why they would have the firstborn would get what they called the double portion. And then I'm going to pause just briefly to give everybody a chance to break out their underliners and their highlighters, because I know you're going to want to highlight and underline these following verses. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed him, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of his city. And they shall say to the elders of the city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. So if you got all your parents want to get this underlined so you don't have to call me later and say, where is that verse that talks about rebellious children again? It's right here in Deuteronomy 21:18-20. Now, first of all, this is not talking about a little kid. Okay, you know, little Johnny skipped Sunday school, skipped kindergarten, and he's a drunkard and a glutton. You know, it's not talking about that. This is referring to. Remember, they would reach adulthood in teenage years in those days, and this is talking about a kid who is presumably of legal age, but he's still leaving. You know, they would stay at home until they were able to. Get married and then go off and start their own home. And if you have a son who is grown in the eyes of the Lord and yet he is rebellious and acting this way, then you bring him to the elders of the city. And then notice what verse 21 says. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. And so you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Wow. Aren't you glad we don't live under the Old Testament today? Probably have a lot less population. I know we would have a lot less rebellion in our homes. I know we would have that. You know, these were God's chosen holy people. Okay? And he says, thus you shall put away the evil from among you. He had, as our song says, he had truly shed his grace upon them. They were his representative nation to all of the world. And he wanted to keep them that way. He wanted them to be that representative nation. He didn't want to have people saying, this is God's holy people, and look at how rebellious the children are. You know, he wanted them to put away that evil from among them. And so regulations regarding that, the stipulations of this were very stringent. It says, if a man, verse 22, committed a sin deserving of death, and he is put to death, you shall hang him on a tree. Now, that's not the method of execution. You know, they didn't tie a rope around their neck and then pull the trap door. You know, this would be something that would be done post-execution. He would be stoned, And then they would take that dead stoned guy and they would hang him on a tree or a stump or something like that. Hang him for public viewing. You shall hang him on a tree. That was a very common thing in those days, to make a public example of what happens to somebody that commits a capital crime. It says that his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, for he who is hanged is cursed of God. So what they would do in those days, what the pagans would do, whenever they would execute somebody, then they would hang them up on a tree or hang them on the side of the city wall or whatever, and then they would leave them there. And they would stay there for days. They would let the birds come and start plucking away at them. And they would leave them there until the body began to rot. And it would serve, people would see this rotting corpse hanging on the side of a wall or on a tree. And it would serve as a very visceral, visual example of what happens to rebels. And God has too much respect for the human life, for the dignity of life for that. And he says, you can do that. You're going to execute him because we're going to have capital crimes, and you can hang him on a tree as a visible representation to the people of what happens, but don't leave him there overnight. Take him down after this has been done, before sundown, take him down and bury him. Interestingly enough, this is the verse that Paul quotes in Galatians chapter 3, where he says, cursed is, with reference to Jesus, cursed is him who's hanged on a tree. And it's not talking about as a method of execution. Jesus was hung on a tree as a method of his execution. But Deuteronomy 21 is not talking about the form of mode of execution, just saying it as an example that this is was fulfilled in Jesus. Chapter 21 was pretty wild, huh? Chapter 22 gets wilder. You shall not see your brother's ox or a sheep going astray and hide yourself from them. You shall certainly bring them back to your brother. You know, if you're sitting out on your front porch one day and you see your next door neighbor's ox heading down the road, don't just look the other way and start whistling Dixie. Don't act like you didn't see it. It's your responsibility. You are your brother's keeper. It's your responsibility to go get that ox and to bring him back home. You can't just look the other way and act like you didn't see it. And if your brother is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it into your own house, and it shall remain with you until your brother seeks it, and then you shall restore it to him. You know, there was no finders keepers or possession is 7/10 of the law kind of thing with Deuteronomy. If you see an ox, it's got a bell on its neck, you know it belongs to somebody, then and you see it wandering down the street, then take it. If you know who it belongs to, give it back to him. If you don't, then hold it until the person that lost it comes looking for it, and then give it back to him. You should do the same with his donkey. You shall do the same with his garment or any lost thing of your brother's which he has lost and you have found, and you shall do likewise. You must not hide yourself. You know, he's talking about there was this community responsibility that we are all in this together. We need each other. We are our brothers, sisters, and brothers and sisters keepers. If somebody has lost something, then it is our communal responsibility to restore it. You know, the Bible would very clearly talk about that it would be wrong to do something was wrong. And what he's talking about here is it's also wrong to not do something that's right. If you know something you should do and you don't do it, then to him that is sin, is what Deuteronomy is saying. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down along the road and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up again. So if your brother, your neighbor, some person is walking down the road with his donkey and he falls into a ditch, don't get up and turn the channels on the TV. You know, figure out that you remembered you had to do something. Go out and help your brother get his donkey. Now, if you ever see somebody in need, Moses is saying, help them. Especially if it's your brother. You know, if you know somebody that's in need of some kind, then you should do something to help them. You should not just ignore their situation. You should not, you should do whatever you can to help them. Now, today we live in a society and a culture where you gotta use some prudence. You know, I don't think it would be wise for anybody, if somebody is broken down the side of the road, for just any of us to stop and help them. Sometimes an unassisted woman, for example, would not be a good idea to stop, for them to stop and help. You know, we live in a society and culture where a lot of There's a lot of evil that goes on. But there's still, even though there's prudence to be exercised in this, the principle is that we are our brother's keepers. We are in this community. We are together. I was sharing before the service of this good pastor friend of mine who died today and went home to be with the Lord, and I was reading some of the testimonies on Facebook this afternoon about how this guy had helped different individuals in times of crisis throughout their years, and him and his family, and the sort of time how they had come and stood alongside and helped and aided and assisted and provided that which was necessary. This is what Moses is talking about here. He says, "A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God." Now, many, in fact, I have known of many churches and denominations who have seen this as a banner passage to say that it is improper, it is bad, it is even a sin for a woman to wear pants. And this would be the verse they would use. Because men should not put on the attire of a woman, and a woman should not put on the attire of a man. And since men wear pants, women should never wear pants. That's the conclusion. But let me ask you, back in the Bible days, how many guys wore pants? You know, back in the Bible days, the guys wore dresses. And so it's not a prohibition about pants or dresses, either one. But I think what it would be saying, and I think this is a very reasonable and rational modern application, today we call it cross-dressing. You know, it does apply in the sense that a man should not dress up like a woman, nor should a woman dress up like a man in order to appear masculine. You know, if a gal is going to be working out in the field and she's going to put on a pair of dungarees and boots so that she can go out and work, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's for a man to try to appear feminine or for a woman to try to appear masculine, that's an abomination to the Lord. I think that's what's being said here. And check this out. I mean, you think God's not interested in the sanctity of life? If a bird's nest happens to be before you along the way, in any tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs, with the mother sitting on the young ones or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall surely let the mother go, and then you can take the young for yourself, that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. Now, if you got the old King James, it calls the mother the dam, which is kind of an archaic way of damsel. You know, it's the mom, the hen. And it's saying if you're going along and you see this nest and it's got some little birdlets in it, and then there's the mama bird there, and you're thinking you'd like to have some baby duck soup. If you do that, don't take the mama duck. You know, because, or if you take the reason for this is, and it's a conservation thing. It's kind of like even with hunting today, sometimes, there's certain seasons where, if you're going out, bird hunting, and it's a certain season, you can do the roosters, but you can't do the hens. And the reason is because if you kill off all the hens, then they wouldn't be having baby, birds the next season. And if you kill off all the moms, then you're gonna kill off the species. And so this is a conservation thing. It's saying if you want to take the baby ducks, that's okay, but don't take the mama because then she can't lay any more eggs. And that's okay. So, if you do that, you'll prolong your days. In other words, you'll have something to eat tomorrow if you, practice conservation here. It's interesting to me that God says to Adam, I want you to multiply and have dominion over the earth. But he didn't say go out and rape the earth. You know, you're going to have dominion over it, but use some common sense with that. You know, here's what your dominion is going to be exercised by in showing conservation, taking care of it. Not because the earth is your mother, but because you're just going to use some wisdom in the process. Verse 8, when you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet for your roof, that it may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household if anyone falls from it. Now, if you got the old King James, it's a little confusing, I think, because instead of parapet, it says battlement. You know, if you're going to build a house, put a battlement around the roof so you don't have any bloodshed. You're not guilty of any bloodshed. And you think, what does that mean? Well, in those days, even today, I can remember the first time we went to Israel, and our first night we were staying in this high-rise hotel, It was like a 20-story hotel or something like that. And we were looking out the hotel window, and you could see all of these apartment buildings down below us. And on the roofs of all of the houses, they had little picnic tables, and there was these little little tyke scooters and playground equipment and stuff like that. And this was the backyard for many of the houses. And it was that way back then, and it's even still that way today, that the roof of the house is where everybody hangs out. It's the coolest place. It's a safe place. You're not going to get run over unless you don't have a parapet around the roof and your kids fall down into the street and then they get run over. So he says to be just, if you're going to build a roof, as soon as you get the roof built, put a parapet around it so that your kids don't get on their little tyke scooter and go off the side and splat down on the sidewalk down below, so that your household will be free of any guilt of bloodshed. Verse 9 says, "You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled." You think, well, why is that in here? You know, what's wrong with me sowing some rutabagas and some corn right next to each other? Because it's not going to yield very well. They're not going to germinate each other very well. It's not a thing of where it's wrong to do this. It's just unwise to do it. Remember, these guys were not farmers. They had never tilled the soil before. They didn't know what they were doing. And so God's just giving them practical advice here. "You shall not plow an ox with a donkey together." You think, well, what's wrong with that? Because I think there's a practical explanation and a spiritual one to this. If you were to take a yoke and tie a donkey and an ox together to it, they're going to pull against each other. An ox has one way of walking and a donkey has another way. And if you tie them both together, you might be thinking two animals are better than one, but these will work against each other and it would be worse than one. And so that's the practical reason for it. The spiritual reason is the Bible says that we should not become unequally yoked with unbelievers. And I think this is a good example of that, because if you're unequally yoked with a non-believer, then the non-believer is going to try to pull this way. You know, the non-believer is going to be a donkey and you're going to be an ox, and you're going to try to go this way and the non-believer is going to want to go that way, and you'll defeat each other. It's also a spiritual application of what Jesus said in Matthew, where he says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm meek and lowly of heart." Jesus has a certain way of walking. He's got a certain gait. And if we're not going to be equally yoked with him, if we're not going to be walking with the same way he's going, walking with the same gait he has, we'll be working against him. He'll be the ox and we'll be the donkey. And so I think there are spiritual lessons with this as well. "You shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together." Now, anybody know the practical reason for that? Because I don't. If you ask me why this is in here, I really don't know. I don't understand why Deuteronomy tells us not to wear clothes that are mixed with wool and linen. Does this mean that if you're wearing some sort of polyester rayon kind of blend shirt today that you're in sin and you need to repent? I don't think so. I don't know what this is meaning. You know, science might come out, and you might wake up in the morning and see this blast on yahoo.com that they've figured out, that they just come to a realization that when you have linen and wool mixed together in a garment, that it causes some sort of chemical reaction with your skin cells and, you know, breaks you out in a rash. I don't know. I mean, there might be some practical, I don't know what the reason is, but he tells them not to do that. And then he says, "You shall make tassels on the four corners of your clothing with which you cover yourselves." This is hearkening back to Numbers chapter 15, verse 37, where he says, "Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue." This is the modern-day prayer shawl. As you see, we have one up here on this communion table, and it's the Hebrew word is tallit. And observant Jews today will actually wear these underneath their shirts. And you'll see them walking around in Israel, or if you're in like New York or L.A., where you have a higher concentration of Jewish population. And you'll see these guys with their white shirts, and they got these tassels hanging out underneath them. And that's why when they pray, they can finger these tassels. It's kind of like the Jewish version of a rosary. You know, they'll it's just something to kind of remind them that they're praying. And it would also distinguish them from the Gentiles. You know, the Gentiles didn't have these prayer shawls, these tallit. They didn't have these blue tassels hanging down. It's to distinguish them from the goyim, the Gentiles. And it was just another way that they would see themselves as a separate people. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, I took this woman, and when I came into her, I found she was not a virgin. Then the father and the mother of a young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young man's virginity to the elders of the city of the gate. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he detests her. And now he's charged her with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin, and yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, which was a lot of moolah back then. 100 shekels of silver, and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name on the virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife, and he cannot divorce her all of his days. So if a guy wants to get out of his marriage, he just figures out he doesn't like the wife. And so as his way out, he goes to his mom and dad, the girl's mom and dad, and says, you guys lied to me. She was supposed to be a virgin. She wasn't a virgin when we got married. It was a common practice then. In fact, in some parts of the world, they still do this, that they would produce the sheets from the wedding night, that they would keep those. They would produce the sheets that would show the evidence of the woman's virginity, and they would show them to the dad, say, or to the husband. They'd say, nope, here they are. These are from your wedding night. And they would take those sheets. I mean, could you imagine how embarrassing this is going to be for the bride? They would take these sheets down to the elders and show them, here's the proof that she was a virgin when we gave them to her, or to him. And if they could produce that, then the guy would be found, fined 100 shekels of silver, given it to the father-in-law. And then he would have to go back and be married to this wife that he just publicly accused of not being a virgin. He'd have to go back and be her husband, and she would be his wife for the rest of their lives. Probably made for some very interesting dinner conversation, I would think, from there on out. You know, I mean, if I were a husband that ever did that, I would probably want to get a food taster before I ate any more of the wife's cooking, that's for sure. But then it says in verse 20, but if the thing is true, and the evidence of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you. That's mighty radical, I gotta say. But I doubt they had to censor very many football commercials during those days. You know, I mean, there was probably a much more chaste society back then than what we are engaged in today. Verse 22 says that if a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die. The man that lay with the husband and the woman and the woman. So you shall put away Israel, evil from Israel. You know, if the woman lies with the husband, this is the idea that both of them were consensual and she's already married or betrothed to a guy, then that's adultery and you're supposed to whack them both. If the young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman because she did not cry out in the city, and the man because he humbled his neighbor's wife, so you shall put away this evil from among you. The idea behind this is if they're in a populated area and some guy tries to force himself on her, she can cry out for help. And if she doesn't, then the idea was that she was complicit, and so she would be responsible. If a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, so they're not in a populated area, they're out in the middle of the sticks, and he forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin deserving of death, for just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so this is in this manner. For he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, but there was no one to save her. If a man finds a young woman who's a virgin, who's not betrothed, and he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he humbled her, and he shall not be permitted to divorce her all of his days. So if a guy goes out and he gets a gal and hauls her into the bedroom, and she's not betrothed to a man, she's single, she's available, as we would say, then he just married her. And he would give the gal's dad the 50 shekels of silver. That would be the dowry, and they would be married. and he would not be permitted to divorce her. A man shall not take his father's wife nor uncover his father's bed. That's chapter 22. Chapter 22 was hairier than chapter 21, wasn't it? Chapter 23, whew. I mean, chapter 22 was uncomfortable even for us to read, much less to teach. But you know what comes after chapter 22? Chapter 23. I remember I was listening to Chuck Swindoll many years ago, and he was talking about when he graduated from Dallas Seminary, he had told his professor that he wanted to be an exegetical teacher. He wanted to teach the Bible verse by verse. And his prof said to him, "You do, and someday you're going to have to teach Hebrews 6. And, you know, that's the passage where it talks about if a guy has tasted the goodness of the Lord, but then he turns back, and then there's no forgiveness for him, and all the different problems men and women have had trying to explain that one over the years. And so his prof said, if you teach verse by verse, you can't avoid Hebrews 6. Someday you're going to have to teach it. I say, if you're going to teach by verse, someday you're going to have to teach Deuteronomy 23. Okay? I'd rather teach Hebrews 6 any day than this one. Verse 1. He who is emasculated by crushing or by mutilation shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. See what I'm saying? Now, this is not talking about some sort of accidental injury. Okay, it's not talking about some sort of birth defect or something like that. This is talking about the practice of men voluntarily becoming eunuchs out of some sort of a pagan practice. It was associated with the pagan ritual, and that's what he's talking about here. One of illegitimate birth, verse 2, shall not enter the assembly of the Lord even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, but why would somebody who is illegitimately born be responsible for the mistake of his mother and father? Why would they be held accountable for that? If you're using the New International Version tonight, it says one who is born of a forbidden marriage. And that's probably maybe a better rendering of this. In fact, the word that's used here for illegitimate, it's a pretty obscure Hebrew word. It's the word mamzer. And it only occurs one other time. It's only used here and one other time. And that's in Zechariah 9:6, where it says, a mixed race shall settle in Ashdod. A mamzer shall settle in Ashdod. So it's the idea of, you know, God doesn't want, this isn't a racial thing or anything like that. It's not some sort of racial superiority or any kind of thing like that. It's the idea that he didn't want his people to be tainted by foreign marriages that would water down their relationship with him, because he knew that when they started bringing in foreign wives and foreign husbands, they would also bring in their foreign gods. And that's what all this is about. It is kind of interesting, though, that it says that a person of this kind of birth shall not enter the assembly of the Lord till the 10th generation. In Ruth chapter 4, it says, now this is the genealogy of Perez. Now, Perez was the illegitimate child of Tamar and Judah, right? Illegitimate son of Judah and Tamar. And it says that this is his genealogy. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Abimadad. Abimadad, Nashon. Nashon, Salmon. Salmon, Boaz. Boaz, Obed. Obed, Jesse. And Jesse begot David. And that's 10 generations. From Perez down to David is 10 generations. Is that what's in mind here? Some Bible guys say, no, the 10th generation just means infinity. You know, it just means on and on and on and on. That might be the meaning, but it is kind of interesting, I think, that there are 10 generations between Perez and King David. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. So the Ammonites and the Moabites, you can't have them. And of course we have Ruth. How that happened? Well, Ruth became a Jew. You know, she proselytized. She said, "Your God shall be my God." And so that's the idea here. Nevertheless, the Lord your God, verse 5, would not listen to Balaam. The Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loves you. You should not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever. But then he says, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. No, Edomites were the descendants of Esau, who was the son of Isaac, who was the progenitor of the Israelites. He said, you shall not abhor an Egyptian. This is kind of interesting, because you are an alien in his land. You know, we think of the relationship to Israel to Egypt, and we always think of the making of the muds and, you know, Charlton Heston and all that, making of the mud bricks and everything. But that was actually a pretty short period of time in the 400 years that they spent in Egypt. Initially, Egypt opened their doors to them and was very nice to them. So don't abhor an Egyptian. The children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly. When your army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. If there is a man, any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp, and he shall not come inside the camp. And it shall be when evening comes that he shall wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. So if one of the guys in your army has like a nocturnal emission or something, then he's unclean and he's got to go get washed. You see why I don't like this chapter? I don't like teaching this chapter. And then you, verse 12, break out your highlighters. Then you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment. And when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuge. Or if you got the old King James, again, here's what the old King James says. Thou shalt have a paddle upon thy weapon, which means you got to have a shovel in your backpack. Now, why does this need to be in the Bible? I ask you, why does it need to tell us in the Bible that we should go out and cover up our business? Because, verse 14, for the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. It's a very practical thing. You should not give back to his master, the slave who has escaped from his master to you. He may dwell with you in your midst in the place which he chooses within one of your gates, and where it seems best to him, you shall not oppress him. So if you got a guy, let's say you got somebody from Edom, and he's a slave, and he escapes from Edom and comes up to Heshron, and he says, I've escaped from my master in Edom. Will you give me safety? Yeah. Deuteronomy 23 says, yeah, you would. In fact, you don't enslave him. You don't make him your servant. You set him free. Israel was going to be, it was a safe place. It was a safe zone. There weren't no triggers in Israel. And it says, verse 17, there shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. It's kind of interesting, the language here. The word ritual harlot in Hebrew is kedeshah. And the word perverted one says you shall not have a ritual harlot or a perverted one. And the word perverted one is the word kadesh. And so it's just the one is the feminine form of the other one. And the reason why this is interesting, the word holy in Hebrew is the word kadosh. It means sanctify or to make holy. And the idea is not that these were, you know, we think of holy as something that's very, like, sacred, something that's godly, but it means something that's set apart. That's what the word means. It means something that's dedicated to a particular use. The vessels of the temple were dedicated to the use of worship of God, period, nothing else. And this is talking about the sexual prostitution that was so endemic in the pagan cultures that would be part of the temple, their temple worship, these guys were holy to their gods. They were sanctified, dedicated to their gods. And he says, you're not going to have that with you. That's a perversion. That's an abomination. Not going to happen. Nor, he says, don't even bring the wages of a harlot or the price of a dog to the house of the Lord your God for any vowed thing or any vowed offering. Both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. The word harlot's just a generic word for prostitute. And the word dog here, actually, if you got the New International Version, it says male prostitute. And it's the Hebrew word for dog, but that's what they would call the male prostitutes, the male temple prostitutes of those days. They called them dogs, and that was just kind of a derogatory name for them. And he says, so even, not only should you not entertain those guys in your midst or those gals, but even the money that is given to them, don't use that for your tithes. You know, don't put that in the agape box because it's an abomination to God. You should not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out of interest. Means exorbitant interest rate. To a foreigner you may charge interest, but to your brother you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that which you have set in your land, in your hand, in the land which you are entering to possess. You know, this is not, again, it's not an ethnic statement. You know, don't do it with the people, with your people, but you can gouge the people that are from other countries. This is just talking about international commerce. You know, today they charge tariffs for imports. Whenever you're bringing in an import from another country, that's the same kind of an idea here, so that you can protect the economy in your own country. When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it. For the Lord your God, this is also in Leviticus, I think it is. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be a sin to you. If you abstain from vowing, it's not a sin. You know, just don't vow. But if you say it, if something goes from your lips, then you shall keep and perform it. For you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you promised with your mouth. It's better to not vow and receive God's grace than to vow and to not do it. And then when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat. This is kind of cool. When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you can eat the fill of the grapes at your pleasure. You're walking along, grab some grapes, munch them down. It's fine. But you should not put it in any container. You know, don't bring a 5-gallon bucket. Don't bring a wheelbarrow. No, don't bring your dump truck. You know, you're not gonna do any harvesting here. Just while you're walking by, remember what Jesus' disciples did as they were walking through the field, and they plucked some grain to get a little Sunday brunch going on, or Sabbath brunch, I guess it was. That's okay, but you can't put it in your pocket and save it for later. And when you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you're not going to put a sickle. You know, when you're going for a stroll, don't take a sickle with you, he's saying, to use it on your neighbor's standing grain. So just very practical, even though somewhat very stark advice that we have in these three chapters. Let's close with a word of prayer. Pretty wild stuff, Lord. I'm so glad we live in this era. I'm glad that we aren't having to sort this out and come to grips with all of these stipulations and regulations. I'm glad that we've got Jesus. I'm glad that we've got your Spirit. I'm glad that you have called us just simply to lives of holiness, and that we can walk in the light of your word under the sun as your Spirit enables us by the grace that comes from your fingers. We rejoice in that, Lord. Thank you. Thank you for your love for us. In Jesus' name, amen.